From KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Maggie Wall. This week we go to the Iliamna Lake region for public hearings on Pebble Mine. It's a region that lacks employment opportunities, and the mine could provide good-paying jobs. The governor announces his appointments for the Board of Fish. At least one of those appointments is likely to prompt heated opposition. And finally, we'll have more on frankenfish, the genetically modified salmon that will be soon hitting American grocery stores. All that coming up on this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report, right after this.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is holding a series of public meetings on the proposed Pebble Mines draft environmental review. Three of those meetings were held in communities on Iliamna Lake. That region and the people that live there would be among the most immediately impacted by the project. KDLG's Izzy Ross traveled to some of those meetings and has this report.
Situated in southwest Alaska, Lake Iliamna is renowned for its pure water, freshwater seals, and fish. Now it is the center of one of the most contentious debates in Alaska. The proposed Pebble Mine would sit 17 miles north of the lake. It would tap into large deposits of copper, gold, and molybdenum, and it would operate at the headwaters of the largest sockeye salmon run in the world. For some, this spells disaster for that habitat and residents' traditional way of life. But others say it is a chance at renewed economic vitality.
So when it comes to submitting comments, there are several ways to submit comments in the EIS. The first is to testify today, and you are not limited.
In Kakanak, around 50 people attended the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers public hearing on the mine, but far fewer people testified. Marlene Nielsen was one of those who spoke in support of the proposal.
What do we have here? The village council that only has 5-6 jobs, the school that only has maybe 2 or 3 aides, and the store maybe 2. That's not very much economy here. We need something going here for our kids, but we also need to make sure it's safe.
Across the lake in Iliamna, Chasity Anilin shared those concerns. She has worked as an operations coordinator for the Pebble Project for the past 10 years.
So I've lived in Iliamna all my life. I have a daughter, and, you know, I choose to live here. This is my home. This is where I want to be. And I am able to live here because I have a job.
She said that job allowed her to build a house and take care of her family. But she acknowledged that the issue is complicated.
I'm just as afraid as everybody else, but I'm also willing to see the process work. And if they can prove that it can be done safe, I feel like it's important for people in our lake area to have jobs. You know, there's been so many people that have left our communities because there's no opportunities here. And when somebody has a job and they're able to come to work and they have pride, it shows, you can tell.
Those sentiments were echoed at the meeting that evening in New Halen, where the overwhelming message was that community members were struggling to find jobs. A major argument against the development is its threat to Bristol-based commercial fisheries. But around the lake, a high unemployment rate and a low number of locally owned fishing permits means the financial incentive of the mine often outweighs ecological risks to the fishery. New Halen Tribal President Henry Olympic is a commercial fisherman, but he said that in addition to fishing, he needed to work full-time to support his family.
Me being a fisherman from New Halen, we don't get that luxury of getting that help from BVDC or just being in the CDQ.
For some, Pebble provides an answer to economic stalemate, but for others, the potential for damage is unacceptable. The hearing in Igiagig featured mainly anti-Pebble testimony. Those opposed to the mine cited threats to subsistence activities and their way of life. That included Cheryl Wassily, who stressed the need to prioritize traditional values.
It's not just about salmon or the abundance of wild animals, but us as people. We are a resource. We belong here and we matter. I want our culture and traditions to be passed down to future generations. If Pebble goes through, it would further push our traditions and culture aside during a time when we are trying to revitalize what was taken from us before.
I think I heard about it first when I was 16. I'm 26, so like 10 years ago.
Alicia Zakhar is a social services worker in Igiagig. She has lived in the area her whole life. The day after the hearing, she drove around town with one of the kids she babysits in tow. Zakhar is against the mine. She says that even if it provides jobs in the short term, when the mine closes, those jobs will disappear. Still, she can understand why some people support it.
So my dad is on the fence about it. Like, he likes the idea of getting money and getting jobs. But he also is a hunter and a fisher.
Zakhar's family lives directly by the mouth of the Krijek River, which feeds into the lake. Walking down to the beach, she points to her family's subsistence site, directly in front of the house where she grew up.
Our subsistence, well, my parents' subsistence net goes, see that red blotch over there? It goes a little bit further than that. Mm-hmm. And then we cut fish right below my parents' house right there.
Zakhar wants to raise a family in Igiagig. She says the economic gains from the mine wouldn't be worth endangering their way of life.
People that haven't been here are probably going to pick like Crow Pebble because they haven't seen like how beautiful it is and what's at risk.
Throughout the hearings, people across the spectrum express the desire to create and maintain communities for their families to live and work. The role Pebble will play is yet to be determined. The public comment period on the draft EIS ends on May 30th. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund, supporting conservation and harvesting of Alaska's wild, sustainable fisheries.
Turning now to Board of Fish appointments. Governor Mike Dunleavy announced 4 appointments to the Alaska Board of Fisheries recently. One of Dunleavy's picks has served on the board in the past and is likely to go through a heated confirmation process. Aaron Bolton at KBBI in Homer has more.
3 of Dunleavy's appointments, if confirmed by the legislature, would replace board members Robert Ruffner, Orville Huntington, and Al Kane. Ruffner, who had reapplied for his position, says he's disappointed with the decision.
Having other voices in there is not necessarily a bad thing. The Kenai Peninsula hasn't had a representative on there in a number of years, and the dependence that we have on fisheries, you know, I think it's important that we have a voice on that board occasionally, and, you know, I would have been happy to do a second term.
Former Superior Court Judge and Board of Fish Chair Carl Johnstone of Anchorage served on the board for 7 years, up until 2015. He resigned after he was told former Governor Bill Walker would not reappoint him to the position later that year. And his potential return to the board is a point of contention for the commercial fishing industry in Upper Cook Inlet.
Johnstone definitely is a concern.
Dino Sutherland sits on the Upper Cook Inlet Drift Association Board of Directors. He says Johnstone supported policies in the past that put more fish into Cook Inlet rivers, favoring the sport fishing industry.
They can only handle so many fish. They have a carrying capacity for optimum yield. That's what we've always fought for. And he has been on record of disregarding that very important science and biological fact. I don't remember anybody making the lake any deeper, making the streams any longer, making the rivers any wider.
Others like Cook Inlet commercial set netter and Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association board member Paul Shadura are concerned about Johnstone returning to the board for other reasons.
Board members in the past have said that his back room arm twisting was very insulting. That he tended to force board members into taking positions they weren't comfortable with.
At least one past Board of Fish member who spoke on background supports Shadura's claim. Johnstone, who did not want to do a radio interview, says he's heard similar claims in the past. He says they are not true. Johnstone does have his supporters, Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, which has been at odds with Cook Inlet commercial fishermen in the past, views Johnstone's return favorably. Ben Moore is the organization's executive director.
We view Judge Johnstone as somebody that's been reasonable in his time on the Board of Fisheries. He's deliberative and thoughtful, and and seems to be fair in his decision-making process.
Still, John Stone has written opinion pieces as recently as 2017, arguing that sport and personal use fisheries should be at the forefront of management decisions. If confirmed, John Stone is likely to grapple with contentious Cook Inlet fisheries, including the allocation of fish and a management plan for salmon fisheries in federal waters. However, John Stone is not the only potential Dunleavy appointee to the board likely to raise eyebrows. Marit Carson Van Dort worked for the Pebble Partnership as recently as February 2018. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska fishermen and their families. AMC at amsea.org or 907-747-3287.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs, 1-800-992-4960, or online at alaskaboat.com.
And finally this week, Frankenfish, that genetically modified salmon, will soon be showing up in stores across America. Alaska Fish Radio's Lainey Welch has details.
After more than two decades, genetically modified salmon, dubbed Frankenfish, has been given the go-ahead to be sold in the USA. On March 8th, the Food and Drug Administration deactivated an import ban on Canadian-grown eggs of the so-called Aqua Advantage salmon, thereby allowing it to be grown to market size in land-based tanks in Indiana. The man-made Atlantic salmon grows three times faster than normal. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, for years, has been an outspoken critic and has questioned if it even can be called a real fish.
It takes a transgenic Atlantic salmon egg, which has genes from an ocean pout, somewhat akin to an eel, and it combines with the genes of a Chinook salmon. I have questioned time and time and time again, why would we want to be messing with Mother Nature like this?
The move into the U.S. was made possible after the U.S. Department of Agriculture enacted labeling guidelines for bioengineered foods. The guidelines won't tell customers what they're buying. Instead, the ID will be buried in barcodes or at 1-800 numbers on a website. Murkowski, who called the decision short-sighted and wrong-headed, will continue the push for better labeling.
To allow for the first time ever this genetically engineered salmon for human consumption, then at a bare minimum, you've got to stick the label on it that says so.
That story was from Alaska Fish Radio's Lainey Welch. That's it for this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from Izzy Ross at KDLG in Dillingham, Aaron Bolton at KBBI in Homer, and Lainey Welch at Alaska Fish Radio. Special thanks for help on the Pebble Meeting story goes out to Elizabeth Harbaugh and Annie Feit of the Alaska Energy Desk, as well as Lori Townsend with Alaska Public Media. Whether you commercial fish, sport fish, or do it for subsistence, remember, life vests really do save lives. Be sure to wear them. For KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Maggie Wall.